Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host, Tom Wheeler, Executive Director of the Environmental Protection Information Center. And joining me, as always, are my co-host, friends, and colleagues, Jen Cault of Humble Baykeeper. Hey, Jen.
Hey, everybody.
Scott Greason of Friends of the Eel River. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Tom.
Hey. And Larry Glass of the North Coast Environmental Center. Hey, Larry.
Hey, Tom.
All right. And we are joined this week by a very special guest. We have Anne Velisis, the author of Abalone, The Remarkable History and Uncertain Future of California's Iconic Shellfish. Thank you, Anne, for joining the Eco News Report.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm really glad to be here with you guys.
All right. Let's start off with just the most basic question, which is, what is an abalone?
So an abalone is a mollusk or a shellfish. The thing that's most distinctive about it is it's got this big, beautiful, iridescent shell. You don't see the iridescence from the outside. It's on the inside. It's also, the way this animal lives is it has a big foot that attaches to rocks and reefs. So there's one species that lives in the intertidal zone, and other species live in deeper zones. So this animal holds on to the rock. It eats what's called drift kelp, pieces of kelp that are kind of get knocked off of kelp plants and is just floating around in the ocean. So it's a great recycler, kind of scavenger. It takes that kelp and makes this beautiful shell and the big, beautiful foot. And it's because of those two things, the foot, of course, so strong to hold the animal, it becomes a piece of meat that people love to go fishing for. And the beautiful shell is, of course, very coveted too. So this animal, for that very reason, has a very rich cultural history with people in California as well. There's seven species on the whole coast of California. Up here in Northern California, we have three, but one is sort of the dominant one, which is red abalone. And that's the one that is the center of the fishery that has gone on for many years, but is now closed.
So in addition to the red abalone, we also have a white abalone, which I think is doing even worse than the red. Is that right?
Well, the white abalone is actually in far Southern California. There's two abalone species that are on the endangered species list. So one is the white abalone and one is the black abalone. Well, the white is in Southern California, far Southern California. The black comes up to sort of the southern part of Northern California. It is also in the endangered species list in Southern California owing to an epidemic disease that wiped it out in the 80s. And maybe we'll come back and talk about that a little bit later.
Why abalone? Why did you write this book at this time?
Well, so my background is I'm an environmental historian, which means I like to write about and study environmental issues from a historical perspective, because I think having the long perspective sometimes gives us insight we don't have when we're just in the middle of it. So often natural resource disputes, especially with wildlife, it kind of comes down to like this idea that there's a pie and every time there is this decision, you kind of cut the pie in half and compromise or whatever. And sometimes you don't see until you take the long perspective that this whittling happens over time, you know. So that's something I've long been interested in. I've written three books. This is my third book, I should say, about this topic. So through my previous books, one about the history of wetlands, one about the history of people's relationship with foods, I kind of became aware of shellfish as a wild food that has been very important to people in the past. Important for food, and also very vulnerable to pollution and to overhunting. I was aware of that kind of stuff. But then I was taking a hike down in Big Sur, and I literally found a shell, and it was so beautiful. It inspired me. I mean, I picked up this shell, and I was just so taken by the beauty of it. And I just wondered, gosh, what is the animal that made this? And you know, I was vaguely aware of abalone. I kind of knew that they had been eaten in the past, but I really didn't know the story of them. And as I started to ask around, you know, I realized that a lot of people have amazing memories, especially people of a certain generation have amazing memories of times when abalone were abundant and they would eat them or hunt them. People who were involved in the industry tell a story about, you know, this great abalone industry that was a big part of the state. But like the story ends there. It didn't go on. And of course, because I realized that we're endangered species at the other end of the story, I just knew that there was an important ecological, social, cultural history to figure out and write about. So I kind of got really smitten and just dove in. And it took me a long time. It's a complex story. It's a saga. It's an epic story that lasts 13,000 years of California history. It's been quite an adventure.
I guess I've never really thought of myself as a person of a certain generation, but I guess I'm getting there because as a kid, I lived in Illinois and I remember coming to California on vacation. Unbeknownst to me, my parents were shopping for a new place to live and we ate abalone in restaurants. And that was in the 1970s. And then sometime, I don't know, in the 80s or 90s, I asked in a restaurant, do you have abalone? And the person said, bologna? And I didn't understand because I had no idea that they had been a really abundant commercial fishery that was, you know, readily available. It was like an iconic California food when I was a kid.
Absolutely.
Now it's not available unless it's farmed abalone.
Yeah. And for many years, you know, it was very abundant. And as I said, people had such good memories of it. And then it kind of dropped off the charts. The fishery declined tremendously in the 1960s for a number of reasons. This kind of gets to the heart of the book. One of the reasons, I have to go back earlier in history, is that basically if we go back to, you know, to before white people showed up, it may well have been that there weren't as many abalone. There weren't a huge abundance of abalone. They probably lived in cracks and crevices, and we think that because we know sea otters were present, and which is a primary predator of abalone. But when white people showed up and brought the fur trade, they decimated sea otters, and there was a period of abalone superabundance. The abalone had basically this giant orgy, were reproducing everywhere. There were just a lot of them. And so as more settlers came for the gold rush, they came to California and saw this abundance of abalone and thought, oh, abalone are naturally productive and naturally abundant. This is what nature looks like here. There's a lot more details, but to just get back to what you were talking about, Jennifer, the thing that's interesting about that is we just believed that this animal was so productive and could be sustainable kind of indefinitely, as we have believed about so many things, that it kind of came as a surprise when the abalone declined and fell off the charts. And it happened because of a series of things. The sea otters returned in Central California. They weren't really entirely extinct, and that was kind of a fascinating story. They came back. Their coming back revealed to people that their understanding of the abalone wasn't quite right. So that was interesting. But then we also had so much fishing going on because it was such a popular shellfish, both commercial fishing and sport fishing, because we had an amazing sport of scuba diving that took off and skin diving. So people really loved to go out and hunt these animals. And then we started to get this other set of things happening, more like environmental stressors, El Niños that became more important. There was an epidemic disease I mentioned. And so often with animals and with wildlife, it's so many things that come together to create problems, to create population declines. And so, you know, it kind of happened without, I think, people really even knowing what hit us. And so abalone disappeared. I tell a little story in my book about how Sunset Magazine is telling everybody to go out and go hunt abalone and come back and have a beach barbecue. And in the mid-70s, there was an article that said, well, if you don't find one, you better bring a can of clams just in case. And that's, I think, kind of one of those cues of they weren't around anymore, you know, except in Northern California, where, in fact, there was never a commercial fishery. And one of the things that I found really interesting in my book is people in Northern California always did their best to keep out commercial fishing so that they could kind of keep the abalone fishery as a locally based sport fishery, recreation fishery, and also for subsistence. So that was a really interesting part of the story as well.
So I'd love to talk a little bit more about history here. In particular, the long history of Native peoples' uses of the abalone in Northern California. Can you speak on this subject? How long have we been utilizing abalone as a fishery?
Well, one of the things that was really amazing and fascinating to figure out is that an abalone shell is probably some of the earliest evidence for a first meal, or, you know, earliest evidence for human habitation on the West Coast. And so down in the Channel Islands is actually where the earliest archaeological history is available, because the Channel Islands have a very intact record of shells and shell middens that go way, way back, 13,000 years. A shell was found that was carried up to a hillside where there was a chert outcropping. So that, you know, was surmised to be Paleo-Indians carrying a kind of portable meal up to eat as they're working on making points that they would be used for hunting. that history is very long in Southern California. We don't have that depth of archaeological history in Northern California because of sea level rise over the past 10,000 years. But we do know that, you know, abalone were used for subsistence about 6,000 years ago. People started to use them for ornaments and tools. Again, in Southern California, we have records of these amazing fish hooks that were made to be, that could be used to catch big fish, and then also pendants and ornaments and decorations for baskets. We know from more historic times that these types of things were used by tribes in Northern California too. The Pomo, of course, have this amazing tradition of basketry with beautiful abalone ornaments. There's a lot in the ethnographic record about that. And we know, too, that this tradition of using abalone for ceremonial purposes, ceremonial dances, continues to this day with the northern tribes that use abalone in their regalia for doing dances in the world renewal ceremonies that they do. It was a really cool thing that I got to do. You guys maybe have gone to this, the intertribal gathering in Eureka, where there are demonstration dances that happen every November. And to go and see people continuing to perform some of these dances with abalone regalia is so powerful and amazing, to think that it's a modern part of this tradition that's been going on the coast for so long. It's really quite amazing. And I couldn't write about everything, obviously, in my book. It could be a whole book about indigenous uses of abalone, but I really wanted to convey how important and meaningful these animals were, though, to Californians before settlement, because I think it's just, it kind of opens your eyes to very different ways of thinking about nature. So it's very cool.
There's quite a few really incredible ceremonial dresses, too, with lots of abalone in the Clark Museum in Eureka. And if our listeners or some of my co-hosts, if you haven't been to the Clark Museum, it is fantastic. They have the biggest collection of Northwest California baskets in the world, and lots of incredible ceremonial regalia. And there are several local tribal members on the board of directors, so the displays are actually culturally appropriate, you know, instead of the way people used to just put a bunch of different disjunct things on a mannequin.
And it's my understanding that some of the regalia in that museum are also taken out and danced, which is a really important part of continuing to having that regalia live and continue to be part of culture. So that's a really wonderful thing to mention, Jennifer.
And I'm really struck by the description you give of the roots of the problem of abalone overfishing and collapse, which is that when we got here, there was, as you describe it, a superabundance that was itself the consequence of...
Yeah, ecosystem, I was already out of whack.
of overfishing and overharvesting the sea otter. And, you know, this is a problem that just keeps coming up over and over again. And I see it in Western Water where, you know, we settled on a way of allocating the Colorado River that was based on, you know, a very short time period that turns out to have been really out of whack with the historical average. And what has that led to in abalone management? And what do you see coming out of that experience in terms of a better understanding of how to work with ecosystems?
Well, it's really interesting. And I think you're just right on. There's many ways in which we're realizing, oh, the what we thought was true is not really true. And what's the consequence of that? With abalone, unfortunately, you know, the big fishery was collapsing kind of as this was being figured out. And so in some ways, you can say we were getting back to maybe the way it was, but we kept going and kept fishing to the point of some of these animals becoming imperiled further. I think what it led to is there was this time when the people who are managing for fisheries, because don't forget, this is like the Department of Fish and Game, they're managing for fisheries, they have for decades, finally realized, oh my gosh, we can't keep managing this for a fishery. These animals are vulnerable. We have to manage them for survival. And once that transition was made, you know, there was a lot more research done, not only on how do we keep up maximum sustainable yield, but what about these animals? What about their life history? What about, you know, what is the limiting factor? What's going on? And, you know, the research led people to understand a lot more about the biology of the animals. It turns out that everybody assumed that you have these animals out there, they throw their gametes out into the water and reproduce, and, you know, it's a big soup and they just keep reproducing forever. Well, it turns out the animals don't reproduce every year. It's not a regular thing that, in fact, maybe there's only a period of recruitment every 10 years or every 15 years when the conditions are right. Or these animals can be, you know, really affected, as I mentioned earlier, by other environmental stresses. And so that led to the closure of the fishery, officially the commercial fishery, in 1997 in Central and Southern California. And after that, the Fish and Game Commission said, you need to come up with a recovery plan. And so the state came up with a plan that was more based on biology of the animals, looked at making sure the animals could be, like, density of the animals, making sure they're close enough together, have neighbors nearby, so when the animals reproduce, the gametes come together. So that was one thing. I mean, California basically did two things in the late 90s. They said, we need to have a fishery management plan for every fishery, and they started looking at marine protected areas as ways of looking at, can we conserve areas so that we're not doing species by species on everything. So those were two things that happened, kind of big picture. But what I see right now as a problem is fisheries management is about fishing, curtailing fishing, limiting fishing. You know, that's the toolbox that we use to manage fisheries for the most part, wild animals we use as food. But right now, when we're up against these new kinds of stressors, like the collapse of the kelp forest, marine diseases that are becoming common with warmer water, blobs, and more frequent El Ninos, these are kind of the climate change issues, stressors. We certainly have to be more precautionary about fishing, but that's not going to do it. We have to get serious about how do we tackle the climate crisis, and how do we make our marine ecosystems more resilient?
You're listening to the Eco News Report, and we'll be right back. We're talking with Anne Velisis about abalone. And we're back. We're talking with author and environmental historian Anne Velisis about her new book, Abalone, The Remarkable History and Uncertain Future of California's Iconic Shellfish.
So I think, you know, there need to be more of us in the room talking about what do we do with our marine ecosystems, not just that there are animals that are going to be fished and eaten. They're whole systems we need to be thinking about, I think, in a different way.
Yeah, and as you point out, when we've already stopped fishing completely for both tribal subsistence and for commercial fishing of so many species that used to be so important here, you know, you can't pump the brakes when you're already stopped. And, you know, the tribal peoples and commercial fisheries really need that abundance. We got to figure out how to get it back.
Yeah, and I think the poignance of that, I mean, when I started this book, I actually started it in 2010, and I actually thought, oh, this is going to be a story where Northern California still has this great fishery. And, you know, so there's this one part of the state is doing things well and the others are trying to make it up. Or, you know, I mean, I totally thought it was going to end up being a different story. And as I'm writing, you know, I mean, obviously I believed in climate change to begin with. But as I'm writing, to see these things start happening and the story that I'm studying and thinking about changing right before our eyes, I mean, I think we're all in that position now of thinking, oh my gosh, is this it? Are we really seeing it happening already? And, you know, we have 30 years of history in Southern California that show us, with increasing frequency of El Ninos, with animals that put their gametes out into the ocean, that they are not going to have food if they rely on kelp. You know, kelp needs cool water with a lot of nutrients. If they're not going to be able to make their gametes in hotter water or have reproduction be successful in hotter water, you know, we know that leads to problems. So it's just another stream of information about what we need to have our eyes open to.
Do you know of research that's ongoing to monitor their populations? One of my students opened my eyes to the surprising fact that most of the population monitoring was being done just by collecting the volunteer abalone cards from people who were diving for them. And what I've read is that there's really not that much data here in Del Norte and Humboldt counties because there's never been a lot of recreational diving for abalone here.
Yeah, the far northern counties in southern Oregon, there are red abalone, but it's the numbers, because it's a far northern part of the range, have been smaller. The abalone are big, but they're smaller numbers. And yes, the fishery, it's kind of been a debate within the fishery. It's always been monitored using landings, which is the number of that was caught by the commercial fishery, and then the number that's caught by the sport fishermen. You know, that's the one way that they pay attention. They also, when they came up with a recovery plan, they established something like 8 index sites up and down the coast from Sonoma up through probably northern Mendocino to be paying attention to what's happening at some high use areas. And so that, I believe, was continuing. I don't know if it's continuing now after the fisheries closed. I believe it is, but on a less frequent schedule. And then there's also volunteer efforts from groups like Reef Check that have continued to do monitoring probably of more sites. And what they have been finding in Mendocino and Sonoma is, you know, we had a massive die-off of kelp and a very extensive area of urchin barrens develop. And I think there are some pockets where kelp remains, and there are places where abalone have actually come in looking for kelp. But compared to what we had just like 6 years ago, it's just like night and day and absolutely heartbreaking to many people. I mean, it's just heartbreaking to see that kind of change.
Yeah, we've seen so many of these major changes in marine life in the last 5 to 10 years. The die-off of the sea stars. There's now a big die-off of eelgrass in parts of Humboldt Bay due to an eelgrass wasting disease that's thought to be related to warmer waters.
It just got me thinking about back in the 70s, and I moved up in 71, and like Jen said, abalone was a regular thing at the local restaurants here. And I also knew a lot of people that dive for abalone, sport fishing for abalone. And I remember as the 70s wore on, they were all complaining to me it was harder and harder to find the abalone. And then you'd start reading on a regular basis in the Times Standard, people dying, you know, because they were going deeper and further out looking for abalone that they couldn't find. And that was the first thing that brought it home to me that the abalone was starting to disappear in the 70s. And then, like Jen said, you go into a restaurant later in the 70s and early 80s, and people look at you like, abalone, what?
Yeah. And, you know, Larry, another thing that's interesting is that, you know, I did say people of a certain age remember them. The other end of that is young people don't know what an abalone is or don't know that it was such a big part of California culture. And that was like another reason why I felt like it was really important to write my book to kind of try to express and explain this. Because, I mean, I love wildlife and I'm a wildlife advocate, but I think animals that we use like abalone for food and for all these other purposes, beauty, and that we have peak experiences with, you know, whether we are divers or beachcombers or eaters, to lose all that, I think, is really poignant. And it kind of makes, you know, it just puts a very human perspective on some of the environmental issues that we face.
Yeah, I saved some of my old abalone shells from the 70s and I show them to my grandkids and try to explain it to them. Yeah, these are abalone shells.
They're so cool. And, you know, the thing about people dying for abalone hunting every year. Usually the fishing season would open in April, and it's a time when there's a lot of rough seas and people would go out, and invariably some people would die because either, you know, just because the ocean's a dangerous place, and sometimes they would have a heart attack or, you know, but it, to me, the thing that I took from that is just, you know, people are so passionate about abalone diving. It's such an important part of so many people's lives that those people are willing to risk their life for it. You know, it was such a powerful experience for them.
So what's it like underwater when you're looking for these critters? I've never been in that situation. It seems kind of terrifying.
Yeah, well, Scott, I would agree with you just a little bit. I was not a diver. Many people come to abalone through diving. I was not. I came to it, as I mentioned, as a beachcomber. But I wanted to go out and have that experience. So a friend generously offered to take me diving with him in Mendocino. And so I was training for a while. I got my wetsuit on. I'm actually do a lot of whitewater boating. So I had my river wetsuit. I got a thick wetsuit. I was actually practicing in the river. You have to put weights on to go down under the water to stay down. And we sea kayaked out into a cove, and he took me down and showed me what things were like. Now, don't forget, this was actually 2013, so this was before the die-off of kelp. And it was just breathtaking to go under the surface of water. It was like one of those things where I realized, oh, I've always looked out at the Pacific and thought it was beautiful and just seen that top sheen, you know, the ocean. But to go under and see all the colors of the different marine alga, and then to see abalone on the rocks, sort of these oval-shaped animals, and they're kind of well camouflaged because undersea life just kind of piles on top, so there's barnacles and seaweed and things. You kind of, it's sort of like going mushroom hunting. You have to kind of get your eyes on to find them. The guy I was with, basically to hunt them, you have a little bar and you pop them off in a moment and carry them up to the surface. To go out and get one, you have to have stamina, you have to have skill and experience to do it. They really have to be earned, I think, which is part of the whole mystique of abalone. And then when you bring them back to shore, I write about this in my book, to eat abalone, you have to pound the foot in order to make it edible. So that's sort of part of the tradition as well. There's a lot of interesting stuff that goes with this animal.
This all sounds pretty bleak, Anne. I mean, do you find notes of hope?
I did, Scott, and I'm so glad you asked that question because I'm an eternal optimist, and so I'm always looking for the optimistic things. And there's two stories I want to leave you on. One is, I mentioned earlier that white abalone, the most endangered species, there's really an active recovery and restoration project going on with the white abalone. It's based on a captive propagation program. They brought in some of the last white abalone. White abalone are like these little cream puff type of abalone, right? Because they have a creamy colored fringe around their outside. And that effort, which has taken like over 20 years, is finally coming to fruition. And the first animals were outplanted last fall. So that's very exciting. And the other thing, which is really quirky and interesting, especially in this age of the coronavirus, is another story, which black abalone, the most endangered abalone there in Southern California, was hit by an epidemic back in the 1980s. And 99% of the animals on the Channel Islands and the mainland shore died off. And that disease at the time was called withering syndrome. It spread to some other species as well. And it just seemed so bleak. Like, how are we ever going to restore these animals that are afflicted by this disease? Well, lo and behold, about 15 years later, one of the researchers who were looking into this looked at the disease, you know, under a microscope and noticed something different was going on. And at first she thought, gosh, is this another disease that we're going to be dealing with? And lo and behold, she figured out that, in fact, it was a virus called a bacteriophage, which is a bacteriophage, which means a bacteria-eating virus. Phage means eating. Bacteria-eating virus. And so that virus was eating this bacterium that had been really decimating abalone. So in this story, the virus actually kind of came through as a positive benefit and seems to have knocked back the disease enough in some cases where abalone are able to not succumb to that bacterial disease. And to me, this is totally mind-blowing because when we think about ecology and food webs and things like that, I don't always remember that we also have, you know, bacteria and viruses as part of that. I mean, nowadays with coronavirus, we're thinking more and more about it, but it's amazing. I mean, we share the ecology with these other creatures as well. And I found it to be incredibly heartening that, you know, maybe it's not all bad. Maybe nature is going to come in and there's going to be some things that we don't know about yet that are going to turn out to help us. So I found that to be hopeful, too.
And you just reminded me of that classic line from Jonathan Swift. Big fleas have little fleas upon their backs to bite them, and little fleas have lesser fleas, and so ad infinitum.
That is a great quote. I'm impressed you have that in your mind. That's wonderful, Scott. I'm going to have to try to memorize it. Oh, okay. That's great.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Anne. Thank you so much to our guest, Anne Velises, the author of Abalone, The Remarkable History and Uncertain Future of California's Iconic Shellfish. Go online and pick yourself up a copy. This would be good summertime reading as you are stuck inside because of the coronavirus.
And if you want to buy the book locally, you can pick one up at either Northtown Books in Arcata or Eureka Books, which is open for curbside pickup. You can go on their websites and order it ahead of time. Give them a call.
Yeah, support our local businesses. Thank you so much, Anne. This has been another episode of the Eco News Report. Thank you to our guest, author, independent scholar, and historian Anne Velises, the author of Abalone, The Remarkable History and Uncertain Future of California's Iconic Shellfish. Join us next week for more environmental news from the North Coast of California on this time and channel.